sky's so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. Call me illogical, I just don't care. Hey, hey,
hey, hey.
It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny day.
Yeah. Hey.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. We'll be taking your calls in just a few minutes at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Ton, I know everyone is now very excited about spring planting because yesterday was beautiful. Even though the wind was still kind of blowing through the trees, people were very excited outside, a lot of projects getting underway. I've seen the landscapers back at it. Feels like spring.
It does. The wind has made it seem colder than it's been, but I've noticed lawns are greening up. I saw daffodils out in front of the station in bloom.
Well, I have some at my house. Mm-hmm.
So they're a little earlier than usual this year, but things are really starting to wake up. Even in the orchards, I spent a day in the orchards last week, and the fruit trees are pushing right along. The apricots will be in bloom, I suspect, within a couple of weeks. And so things are moving.
Right. Last few weeks, we've been talking about spring blooming plants. This morning, we wanted to focus on the summer blooming bulbs, because if you want some summer blooming bulbs, it's about that time that you're going to want to plant those.
It is. Start watching for things, because the time to plant is going to be closer to late April into May, when we start to have a chance of frost diminishing for most of these things. But a lot of them you can order now. Some of them are becoming more available in stores.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the summer blooming bulbs. We are talking about the dahlias, the gladiolas, the Asiatic lilies, those kinds of things.
Yes, there are many of them out there, and they get lumped into the bulb group, though that's kind of nebulous. A lot of them are not actually bulbs, which I guess I'm more concerned about that than some,
mm-hmm.
you know, when we plant. But there are many of these that if we lived
like tubers,
yeah, tubers and all sorts of different things. If we lived in a slightly warmer climate, they would overwinter on their own. Dahlias, if we were 10 to 15 degrees warmer in the winter, would be just fine outside. They would come back and do their thing. But we have to dig them. Some of these we don't need to. And so it just really depends on the species. But
most of them you do need to take out.
Most of them you do need to take out.
And that's where the complication arises for me. I used to plant tons of dahlias, take them out for the winter, overwinter them, and put them back. But that takes a great deal of work.
It does. Some people
commitment.
I see that do such things, the kind of a compromise is to get a bag of steer manure and put a pile 6 inches high over every dahlia after it's frozen back for the fall, and then cover that steer manure with some bark mulch. And what will happen over the winter is that steer manure breaks down. It heats the soil up a little bit. And if we don't get too cold, the dahlias will overwinter in the soil that way. And so there are some things you can try. You can try that.
I'm never trying
that. The cannas are another one that sometimes overwinter if they're against a building, but you can cover those with 4 or 5 inches of bark mulch and then rake it off in late March. And they will oftentimes overwinter. So several of these things will overwinter if we don't get too cold. But a few, you know, the Asiatic lilies, the Oriental lilies are perfectly cold hardy. But we just usually plant them in the spring.
Okay. What other interesting bulbs are there out there that we don't often think about for summer bulbs?
Well,
I mentioned the general ones.
Elephant ears are one that we would consider in this group. And those are a great big foliage plant to get 3 or 4 feet tall. Some other ones, gladiolas, and I think people do plant those, but they're not super common.
They think about them as being the cemetery plant.
Yes, and so in the industry, they're
it's
oftentimes
gotten a
just
bad
called
reputation.
Glads, but there are so many neat,
they're so beautiful though,
gladiola
right.
varieties and species. And I actually could get them to overwinter in protected areas up in Cache Valley, so I think they're hardier than people will give credit. But some others, caladium is another one, and they have a oftentimes variegated foliage with pink in them, and they do well in kind of semi-shaded areas. But irises are really common. Hardy cyclamen is another one. They look similar to the cyclamens you can buy, but you plant them and then they'll leaf out and then go dormant, and then they flower in the fall and then go dormant again. So the hardy cyclamens, crocosmia is another one. Sometimes it's called sulfur, I think sulfur lily, but crocosmia has these brilliant red or yellow flowers that come out in kind of a spray that are really pretty. And so there's a number of them out there. I mean, if you wanted to get online, websites like Brex, the bulb company, has a number of options, and some of them are less common, but there are all sorts of places online to order, but the local garden centers and box stores will have a huge selection too.
What else do we need to think about when we're planting summer bulbs?
Just make sure that the soil's loose, but not too, you know, too loose. Most of these bulbs are native to areas where there's more organic matter in the soil, so it may not hurt to mix in some compost around them. Some of them may benefit from just a little bit of fertilizer, but most of them do fairly well.
I've had gladiolas actually come back in my courtyard because it's a total different climate in there. But then after a few years, they kind of died off. What is the length or what is the lifetime of bulbs, summer bulbs?
It just really depends on the species. You know, the lilies will last for years and they naturalize a little bit. And so if you plant one 10 years down the road, you might have five or six of them growing, and they just kind of spread out and they'll form pups. But others, like you mentioned, the gladiolas and even the dahlias, if they're not brought in and they do overwinter, you probably don't want to expect more than 3 or 4 years out of them. The iris are really long lived. Hardy cyclamens, probably 3 or 4 or 5 years and they're done. One thing I found interesting is they put daylilies into this group in a lot of websites. And we usually plant them from pots, but you can find the starts for daylilies. And the Latin name, Hemerocallis, in Latin means beautiful for a day.
Right.
And so the Latin name matches the English common name on it. But I just thought that somebody would take the time to name them that in Latin.
That is funny. The funny thing about them is they only last for a day, the flower, but if you have a bunch of them, they don't bloom on the same day. So
No. They
last more than a day.
They do. So once the plants are established, they will bloom usually for anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. If we have temperatures that are cooler in the late spring and summer, Stella de Oro, if temperatures are consistently below 85, will bloom. And so we get about 6 weeks out of Stella daylily and sometimes some fall blooms. But I've noticed in warmer climates like San Diego and Los Angeles, those Stella daylilies will bloom a lot of the winter, you know, especially spring and fall. And so it's interesting to see some of these outside of Utah in other climates. But daylilies, there's hundreds of varieties and species available. You know, so there are a lot of options mm-hmm. out there.
I needed to transplant a bunch of them last year, so I'm waiting to see how they do.
I bet
you
they do fine.
Okay, well, we'll find out. I'll report on that as they start to come up. Anything else about the summer bulbs?
Just be aware they are out there and that there are options. You know, even tuberous begonias, a lot of people don't like begonias, and it seems like people are either successful or they're not. But you can plant those. There's also the fibrous begonias you can look at that do well in shade. And so maybe if you space them correctly, you would put them in with elephant ear and caladiums in those areas. But there's just a lot of different options.
All right. And we're getting excited about planting. You can find out more about the summer blooming bulbs on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. We're going to come back with your calls and questions. Number to call, 801-575-8255. Text us, 57500. Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls at 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open right now. You can text us at 57500. Let's go to our first text question of the morning, and this person would like to know, what vegetable seeds should they be direct seeding now?
Already, must I forgot turn on to your turn mic. On the microphone, mm-hmm. So... Spinach, radishes, peas, onions, cabbage, broccoli.
Can go directly outside right now.
Yes, especially peas can go in about any time. In a week or so, they can start in with beets and cauliflower, lettuce around late March. You know, there's a lot of things they can do. Swiss chard's another one.
How late in the season can you plant peas? Because I do this wrong every
Probably
year.
Not past the first or second week of April. The okay. second week of April, you're really pushing it and you may not get a crop.
Okay. Okay, that's something I need to worry about.
Yes.
And I've got, my trellises aren't going to be here for another week or so. I was mentioning to you off air, I have to grow vertically since I've eliminated a large amount of space in my vegetable garden.
You are living in a construction project right now.
It's really not fun. That's all I'm going to say about that. Next person would like to know, what's causing the bark to disappear off of some of their peach tree branches? What would cause that?
Probably southwest winter injury from winter sun. The sap flows during the day when the bark heats the, or when the sun heats the bark up, and then the sap freezes at night and bursts the cells in the conductive tissue, and the bark under, you know, that's over the top, because the conductive tissue is dead, sloughs off and you just see bare wood.
Okay. Will it grow back or what happens
if
with that?
It is remedied. So what we recommend doing is on the south and west sides of the trees, the trunk and major limbs, paint them with water-based latex paint that's white. Mm-hmm. And you do this in the fall. And that will protect those areas, and the bark just kind of grows around it. The paint eventually sloughs off, but that would be the solution for that. Or you can get tree wrap, which is a white gauze tape with no sticky on it, and you wrap the trunk and lower limbs with it, and you can just take it off and reuse it.
Okay. Next person would like to know, is it too early to turn on their sprinkler system for the spring?
It is. Just leave that sprinkler system off. Now, the exception would be if you are putting in cool season crops and you need to irrigate, you could activate a portion for that. But we generally don't need to start irrigating our lawns until anywhere from late April through May. And there's a law that I think it may have been passed that's actually the fall. You can't water your lawn after October 1st, but a lot of irrigation companies and cities are looking at maybe not even letting people water their lawns until mid to late May to June 1st.
Okay, but they can start preparing their sprinklers for the season.
They can. It's still, if I'm assuming they're on culinary. And the things I would be cautious of is if we get cold, you know, down into the teens and there's water in the sprinkler heads, those sprinkler heads may freeze. And so I would be a little cautious, but if the weather dictates, they may be able to test to make sure everything's still functioning.
The next listener would like you to give them some good ideas for replacing perennial salvia.
Oh boy, there are other perennial salvias out there. Mainite, which is a dark purple salvia, used to be our go-to. And it's an older variety that has a tendency, it only blooms for 2 or 3 weeks and it kind of flops over. Even if you deadhead it, the new blooms that come back are not that spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
But there, I would look at some of the newer salvias. I would jump on Perennial Favorites website and take a look at what they have, because there would be some options there. Man, if they're wanting something that's going to be a little later blooming, but they could do the hummingbird mints. They're related to salvia. They attract pollinators in. Hummingbird mint will bloom from July through October, especially the southwestern varieties. They have kind of an anisey, licoricey scent to the leaves that mm-hmm. in some parts of the country and in like Korea, they use hummingbird mint as an herb in salads and teas and things. So it's a really neat one just because it will attract the pollinators in, but they are very beautiful and they bloom the last half of the summer.
Is there a salvia that blooms most of the summer rather than just once or twice?
Some of them will, but they are not completely hardy. Salvia greggii, and I don't know what the common name on that is, but Salvia greggii will bloom the entire summer. And it sometimes overwinters here, but it's one that if we were 10 degrees warmer, so Moab, St. George, it would easily overwinter. Some of our native salvias, I'm trying to remember the names of them, but we have one or two native salvias that have pink flowers that bloom a lot of the summer.
Okay. Next listener would like to know, they'd like to fertilize their 5-year-old ivory silk lilac trees. And what would you recommend would be the best way to fertilize those?
I would just get some lawn fertilizer as long as it's not weed and feed. And if they're 5 years old, I would probably use a half of a cup, maybe 3/4, and just spread it under the canopy of the trees in mid to late March. And that's all they really need to do.
Okay. Next listener wants to know, should they prune fruit trees that were just planted last year?
Yes, they should. Get on some pruning videos USU has put together on YouTube. Look up the fact sheets on pruning new trees, but it is critical to prune those the first few years because you're developing the canopy for the tree for the rest of its life. And one of the biggest mistakes we make is not pruning. And then down the road, because of the fruit load, the branches collapse and snap because we didn't do proper training up front.
Okay. Next listener says that they've heard of a ground cover called Manzanita. How well will that do here?
Some varieties do so well. Bearberry is one of them, Arctostaphylos uva ursi, and it's a really low mat forming one, but there are some hybrid manzanitas that, if they can find them, are wonderful, that get taller, about 18 inches tall. But so there's 3 or 4 manzanitas that do well. The easiest to find is called Bearberry.
Okay. I'm not sure I know what the manzanita look like.
They look a little like a prostrate cotoneaster or maybe just a little bit like Vinca minor, the lesser periwinkle. We'll look up some pictures on break.
I will. Okay. So the next listener would like to know when they should put iron on silver maple trees that have iron chlorosis.
Anytime. I would head to the farm store or garden center to pick up the EDDH iron. The most common brand is Miller's Ferra Plus. There's also Grow More chelated iron, and get that mixed up and put it on. Now I would also put on a light application of nitrogen fertilizer and maybe even some liquid humates or granular humates to do everything you can to maximize uptake of that iron.
Okay, so they were wondering what was the best way to apply those. But
mixed up in a 5-gallon bucket. We used to recommend drilling holes in the soil, and our urban forester, who recently retired, has talked in conversation with him and said you may as well just mix it up and then apply it with a 5-gallon bucket, just drenching in a kind of a snake pattern back and forth under the canopy of the tree, and then get your hose out and then just water it in for 10 or 15 minutes so that it gets into the soil, or time it with a rainstorm.
Okay. We're going to come back with your calls and questions. The phone lines are open now. You might want to call before it gets too busy. 801-575-8255. Text us 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis with you this morning. We're taking your calls at 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open now, and you can text us your questions at 57500. Ton, our next listener would like to know, when's the best time to put the first application of fertilizer on a pasture?
Pastures. Now, I'm going to default to my brethren and sister, and I guess, in the ag world.
Okay.
But for turf in your lawn, it would be mid-April to early May, mm-hmm. as late as Mother's Day. But I would say, just with general turf knowledge, I would wait until May to do that. And then the other critical time is going to be in the fall, just so that you can get that grass going faster in the spring. And so if you put another application, even a light one, down sometime in mid to late October, the grass will green up a week or two ahead of what it would.
Okay. Next listener would like to know, is there any way to shade a hydrangea in the month of July and August so that they don't get the blooms burned?
You can try putting a shade structure over them where you would get some posts and stretch some shade cloth, but I don't know of anything super elegant unless you wanted to build like a pergola or build something that you could kind of get them the shade, but then you would run some clematis or some wisteria or something up so that it just naturally provided some shade there. It's really tough to modify the environment for the plant as compared to just planting something where it's more adapted for the environment. So the hydrangea would be planted somewhere where there's afternoon shade.
Next person would like to know, is it too soon to aerate their lawn?
Not really. It's not a great time, but there's companies out there with hundreds of companies that words are really hard this morning, but there's companies out there with hundreds of customers that they just need to get it done. And so I would prefer to wait another 2 or 3 weeks, but if there's a company offering and that's when they can do it, it's not going to kill the lawn.
Well, and then this next week is supposed to be very lovely.
It is. And so without several days of rain, the soil will dry out a bit. And so the soil will be at the right moisture level to pull those plugs out so that you don't actually do more damage to the soil by compacting it.
How would they decide? I mean, everybody's yard's different depending on which way the lawn is facing, west or whatever. How would they decide if the soil is okay right now?
Well, if they can go to an area where they have open soil, like a flower bed or a vegetable garden, just get a shovel and stick it into the soil and all the way to the top of the blade so that it's all the way in the soil, and just lift it up and then turn the soil. And if the soil sticks and is gummy and it sticks to the metal on the shovel, it's too wet. But if you can go out and dig, and it's still kind of easy to get the shovel in, but for the most part, the soil doesn't stick to the shovel, then mm-hmm. that's the right soil texture, consistency of moisture that you want.
Okay, next listener is John in Tremonton. He says he likes the open vase pruning in peach trees. He planted a semi-dwarf Chinese apricot last year, and could it be pruned using the open vase technique?
It can, and what I would recommend with apricots is they get big, and don't cut all the wood off lower down.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to work around it, but the biggest mistake we make with peaches and apricots is we like to clean all the middle wood out and then leave the foliage on the tips. And what will happen over 10 or 15 years, you have to have a ladder to be able to pick the fruit, and it just becomes a hazard, hard to pick. And the apricot will eventually get that big, but watch some pruning videos. But leave fruiting wood lower down. There is no reason to clean it all off until the end third of the branch. The other thing you're doing when you do that is that the fruit, if you can imagine holding a 10-pound weight in your hand with your arm extended horizontally, it's going to be super heavy and you can't support that. Well, how do you think the tree feels when all the fruit's out there on the very edge? And so you have to leave fruiting wood the length of the branch so that the fruit is evenly distributed along the entire branch.
Next listener has another aeration question. They want to know, is it necessary to have the lawn aerated? And is it a problem getting weeds or diseases from other people's lawns?
It's kind of like sharing toothbrushes with other people sometimes when you pass these aerators mm-hmm. around from lawn to lawn. What you can do is check your soil compaction. If the only time your lawn sees traffic is when you mow it, you can probably get away with aerating every 2 to 3 years. if you have more foot traffic on it, and especially if you have a clay or a loamy soil, I would recommend aerating it annually and leave the plugs on. And then as far as aerators go, there's nothing you can do because they're doing hundreds of lawns. But if you rented one, you may be able to get your hose out and at least wash it off and try to clean the debris out before you use it. But that's about all you can really do.
Next listener would like you to go back to the peach question. They want to know which is better for peaches and apricots, modified central leader or the open vase?
Peaches, always open vase. Apricots, it doesn't matter. They're okay. Usually open center. But if you wanted to do modified central leader, that would be fine too.
Because they're smaller and don't weigh as much? Why
just
is that?
Their growth habit is a little more rounded, and you can use either open center or modified central leader pruning with apricots. And the important thing is to get them pruned. And so if they're willing and they know how, then the modified central leader is great, but so is open center.
Okay, we have a couple minutes here to talk about tree planting. When is the best time to plant trees, and what is the best way to make sure that you're going to be successful?
The best time to plant a tree is when you can dig a hole.
Which is now.
Spring and fall, it's a little cooler, it's a little easier on the trees, but you can plant as long as you can dig through the middle of the summer. So just dig your hole, and the main thing you're looking for is the graft union on the trunk of the tree. And as you go toward the base, you will see a knot at the right above what's called the root flare.
Okay.
The root flare is where the roots start, and that's where the trunk starts to expand into the roots. And so that graft union has to be above ground. And so you look for that. And a lot of times trees in the nurseries, especially if they're bigger, are transplanted over and over into new pots, and they will get buried. And so it's not uncommon to find trees that are in the pot already 3 or 4 inches too deep, and you remove the soil until you see the root flare and the graft union.
Okay.
So once you find that root flare and the graft union, you dig the hole to a point where the root flare is even with the ground. And so you want to see the trunk expanding and flaring out, and that goes right above ground. And don't dig the hole any deeper than that because you don't want the soil to settle, but you can dig it wider just so that you can work around the tree a little bit. You want it 6 inches to a foot wider so that you can work the tree and get it settled and positioned how you want and get some soil underneath to get it so that it's straight. And then if the tree is really big, a lot of times nurseries will require staking, especially bald and burlap tree, those are the ones that come in the wire basket for 1 year so that the tree doesn't blow over. And so a lot of times people will use T-posts, or you can get ponderosa stakes that are a couple inches wide and 6 or 8 feet long. And so you can stake them, the larger trees, from one or two sides. And the reason we're staking them is bald and burlap trees will have that wire basket, and it needs to be removed or clipped away.
Okay.
And so you get it in the hole. So you're putting the B&B tree in the hole. And then once it's in there and positioned and you're happy with how it looks, you get some wire cutters and clip the wire off about the top half or top 2/3 of the tree. You can leave the bottom of the basket in and then cut the twine away from the trunk, so that it doesn't girdle the tree as the trunk expands out. And because you've cut that wire basket and the string, that's why we stake bald and burlap trees for a year, so they can get some roots reestablished so that they're more resistant to tipping over in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bald and burlap trees, this might be something that we could do a video on this spring. And
I know someone planting trees. So we
yes.
Can do this. Yeah.
And so if we could convince Michelle to
come
be
out
our
to my house
videographer,
and help me plant trees,
we could plant some trees and just shoot some video of it. So
okay.
That
way, that's a great way for me to
properly.
Get some extra help. Thanks, Tom.
So, yeah.
Appreciate that. Well, we're going to take a break. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse Show. Spending your Saturday morning with us, Maria and Ton with you this morning. Number to call 801-575-8255. Phone lines are open, or you can text us at 57500. Next person would like to know, Ton. He says, or she says, last year you recommended a low shrub. They think it's called the Grow Low Sumac, which, and they want to know if that's invasive, as invasive as the elkhorn.
Well, not really, but you don't want to overwater them. If you have elkhorn or the staghorn sumac going everywhere, it's being watered too much. And so if you get your lawn irrigation going on staghorn sumac, you plant one and you will have 20,
mm-hmm.
because it's a suckering shrub. And so the Grow Low Sumac is grown as a ground cover or a shrub that will cover 5 or 6 feet wide at least. And so you need to be aware of what it does. Now, Grow Low Sumac can be hedged so that it's about 18 inches tall, and it's actually quite pretty when you do that. But don't overwater it, because the sumacs will survive and be perfectly happy being deep watered every couple of weeks.
Next listener wants to know, do you recommend dethatching a lawn? And if so, should that be done before or after you aerate?
I do not usually recommend dethatching because it's so rough on your lawn. Now, if you have 2 or 3 inches of thatch and you're ready just to start over, it may be worth doing. And at the same time, you would heavily aerate once you've dethatched to try to loosen the soil. Because dethatching without loosening the soil will just make it so that the thatch comes back. And the reason you're getting thatch is because water can't penetrate into the soil deeply enough, and the roots are only a few inches deep in the soil. And so you get a buildup of thatch that the lawn actually starts rooting into instead of the soil. And so even if you can pull those plugs out that go 3 inches, that will help. And then I would aerate once or twice a year.
Is there a difference between dethatching and raking? Can you rake off some of that?
You can rake the thatch out. It's still kind of rough on the lawn. It's just that hand raking the thatch out is just more likely to give you a heart attack or an unfortunate cardiovascular event that may require an ambulance.
Okay. Brent is on the line in Draper. Good morning, Brent. What was your question?
Good morning. I have a question about wisteria. We have a wisteria plant that has been in the ground for probably 10 years, and it did well till last year, and it just all the leaves died out, and the trunk seems to also be dead. I'm wondering if I just cut that off at the ground, if there's any chance that I get new growth off of the root.
Maybe. It just depends on if the disease or whatever's in there made it into the root systems. It sounds like maybe a sudden vascular wilt disease to where it clogged the conductive tissue and the plant collapsed, got it. But you don't know. So all you can do is just cut it back. And if it doesn't send new sprouts up by mid-June, then I don't think it will.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
All right, Brent, thanks for your call. Next listener wants to know, is there a reason not to just buy seeds from Walmart or any big box store?
Not necessarily. I like to try to support local garden centers and farm stores, because we're losing especially garden centers right and left. And so anything I can do to support them. But Walmart, Home Depot, they have a wide selection of seeds that sometimes you can't find the varieties you need anywhere else. And so I don't have a problem shopping there, but I usually default to the locals first.
Okay, I'm going to live dangerously, try to get Delia in before the top of the hour. Delia, good morning. What was your question this morning?
Well, I need to plant some roses, and I've been reading up on roses, and I didn't know whether to buy a bare root or a potted rose.
It doesn't matter. Bare root, you could get in really soon. And what I would recommend doing is just getting it planted and then make sure it doesn't dry out. It'll survive just fine. And the bare roots are oftentimes less expensive, but the potted roses are fine too. And those.
Okay, so either or.
Either
so
or.
Do I start now? Do I? Is this a good time to start, or do I wait a while?
If you're, I know that roses have hit the box stores, the bare roots one, and those I would get planted. But the potted roses, if they're established, you're going to have to wait until late April to mid May.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for your call this morning. We need to take a break for the top of the hour news. Number to call, 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500.
Never seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing, I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey. It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now.
My pocket's empty, my cupboard's bare. But call me illogical, I just don't care.
Hey, hey, hey.
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. We'll be taking your calls and questions in just a moment, but the top of the hour feature this morning, we want to talk about roses. Last week on the Greenhouse Show, about a quarter of the questions we got had to do with roses. So we want to bring on the president of the Utah Rose Society. Elise Hutchings is with us. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Exciting to have you. So the first question that I had, though, is are there some new varieties of roses that people should be excited about this year?
Yes, there are. The rose breeders are continually introducing new varieties every year. But I don't think we're going to be able to answer all of your questions in this time, so I'm going to be giving you some other resources and websites to check out that will go into greater length. The first one I'm going to let you know about is the Utah Rose Society website, and it's utahrose.org, R-O-S-E.org. If you click on the blog, there are some videos. There's one on the Utah, a variety of new and notable roses for 2024. There's also a video of new roses from Star Roses, which includes some really interesting information on the lengthy process of hybridizing roses. So that will give you a lot of information about the new varieties that you'll be interested in.
Okay, perfect. But I got to ask you, what is your favorite? What's the one that you're going to plant this year?
Oh, you know, that's so tough because when new ones come out, I just think, oh, I've got to have all of them. So
one of each.
But I don't have enough room, so I will just have to be very particular.
And for me, it's often situational because do you need a ground cover rose? Do you need a bush rose? Do you need a hybrid tea? Do you need a David Austin? And so it's almost like I have to list two or three from every category, and then we're here for, you know, 30 minutes trying to rattle them all off.
Uh-huh.
So what are your best tips for growing healthy roses?
Roses need 6 to 8 hours of sunlight every day, good soil, fertilizer throughout the growing season, and water. But they don't like wet feet. All roses are naturally drought tolerant. Roses actually need 50% of the water that you would give turf grass. And actually, roses are easier to grow than a lot of people think.
So what mistakes are people making that they assume that roses are hard to plant?
Well, you know, there are a lot of videos that explain to you about how to plant a rose. You just... they're not hard. It depends on whether you're getting roses that are already established or...
the bare root?
Bare root roses, yes, uh-huh. And so I think the mistake that people might make is that they think that they don't give them enough room for the roots to grow. And they saturate them with water. You have to do that to get in the beginning when you plant them. but you don't have to water them to death after they're established. And it takes a while for the roses to become established, so you have to be patient and, you know, just check and make sure that they don't have diseases. I don't know that people make mistakes when they plant roses, unless they don't dig the hole big enough, for example.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, there are so many beautiful flowers out there. Why roses? Why are you passionate about roses?
Well, the rose is a national flower. Roses are associated with love. Roses are beautiful and fragrant. And as I said, they're easier to grow than most people think. There are thousands of varieties. So who doesn't love roses?
Right.
Well, and there's so many out there that you can be sentimental about. I mean, oh, there's a sentimental rose, but I mean, one of my favorites, and it's all because of sentiment. My grandpa was a rosarian and loved Chrysler cars. He sold them for a while. And so one that I've tried to have, I need to get one again, that I always put in my yard is Chrysler Imperial, just because of, it reminds me of my grandpa.
Oh, and it is a beautiful dark red rose.
Yeah.
That's very fragrant. Yeah, that's an all-time favorite, that's for sure.
Well, it used to be, a real sign of wealth. If you were wealthy and you had a mansion, you always had a rose bed, not just, you know, just a row of roses, but actually had a rose bed off your dining room.
Oh, well, that doesn't surprise me because that's been going on for hundreds of years. And we have some people in the Rose Society who have, we had one who had 400 roses, another one who had 900 roses.
Oh, my.
So sometimes you just get really hooked, and then you just dig up more grass.
So tell us a little bit about the Rose Society before we have to let you go. What do you do? How do people get involved?
Okay. The Rose Society is an organization that's affiliated with the American Rose Society. The intent is to provide education to the community regarding rose growing and culture. We have meetings every month at the Garden Center in Sugar House Park. And then during the summer, we have garden tours to our members' gardens. We have consulting rosarians that will answer your questions and even come to your home and give you advice. We have a very strong Facebook group that also provides information. And we have a rose exhibit every year in June. This year, the Rose Show is going to be June 8th at the Garden Center in Sugar House Park. Do you want me to give you the address, or do you have that?
No, they can probably find the Sugar House Park address. I do want to know, before we let you go, though, where is your favorite place to buy roses?
Okay, we have a lot of nursery partners, and they are listed on our website. So you can order them online, or you can order them. We like to support our local nurseries.
Absolutely. So, give us your website again.
Okay, it's utahrose.org.
All right, Elise, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Okay, I'm very happy that you let me come.
Great. Have a great day.
Okay, thanks. You too.
And that is Elise Hutchings. She's the president of Utah Rose Society. We're going to take a break. Come back with your calls and questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us at 57500. Good morning, and thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chaleos, Ton Bettis with you this morning. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can also text us your questions at 57500. James has been waiting very patiently in Centerville. Good morning, James. What is your question this morning?
Several of them. Take what you can.
Go ahead.
Let me just say on the onset, this is a great program, and you guys do a great job. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, James.
I'm transplanting some rhubarb and peonies that the bed has been overtaken by some grasses, some wild grasses. So today I'd like to dig them up and try to get rid of the grasses in the soil. and that might take a couple of days, or you know, that might take a couple of days. So I'm wondering the best way to store those peonies and that rhubarb until I can replant them.
I would put them in some nursery pots with potting soil, and if you were going to plant them within the week to 10 days so they don't break dormancy and start to root out, that would be fine. And what you could do is another option would be, depending on their size, is actually to put them in potting soil that has some moisture in it, almost like a wrung out sponge, and refrigerate them for several days until you can get things cleaned up and get them replanted. But otherwise, I would just pull them out of the ground like you were going to move them or split them, and get some nursery pots or some buckets. And you want drainage holes in the bottom. And sometimes nurseries will give you or sell you used pots relatively inexpensively. And I would look at taking those and just putting them maybe on the north side of your house where they're cool and shaded, because you don't want them to break dormancy, and then replant them when you're done. Now, if they start to break dormancy and form roots, you may need to let them root out into those pots and get established before you replant them.
And I could still do that this spring sometime?
Sooner the better, because they are going to start breaking dormancy very soon.
All right, yeah.
If they're already popping up, then I wouldn't do it, because you may kill them.
Yeah, I haven't seen them sprout yet. They've been prolific. They've been very good plants. Yeah,
I would, with the warmer weather, I would give it probably a week before those, especially the peonies, start to pop up out of the ground. And if they do, you're had, and you'll have to leave them there.
Okay. About treating the soil, if the soil is heated, like with a propane torch, or I don't want to use necessarily chemicals. Will it kill the organisms, the seedlings?
That's an interesting question. And because you would assume so, but if you can imagine how dense soil is and how much it would take to go 6 inches deep and heat it to 140 to 160 degrees for several hours to kill all the weed seeds in the soil. Because that's what you would have to do. And so there are instances, like I believe the Amish, sometimes if they have outbreaks in their fields, will start huge fires with hardwood and get the coal and then bury it in the soil and leave it there, because these hardwood coals will burn for hours and heat the soil that way. But it's a very impractical thing to do. And so a Passover with a torch wouldn't heat more than the top 16th to 8th inch of soil, and you would have to be able to sustain that heat until the soil was up between 140 and 160 degrees for several hours.
All right. That's a good answer. And it also, your advice about putting it on the north side, I was thinking I'd move them inside the garage, but I want to keep those plants as cool as possible.
Yeah, I think the north side will stay cooler. You could even get some bark mulch or soil and pile it around the pots and up to the lip of the pot to keep the root and the soil even cooler.
All right, that's a good idea.
All right,
James. You got time for another question?
No, I'm afraid we have four people waiting on the line, but thank you so much for listening and calling this morning. Next listener wants to know, Ton, how and when should they prune Carol Mackie Daphne?
Oh, don't
touch it, right?
They take over
sometimes.
You do the as minimal a pruning as you can, and if it's growing into a sidewalk, follow the branch back to a point where you have some side branches and just clip the entire branch out and leave it alone.
All right. Debbie is on the line in Sandy. Good morning, Debbie. What was your question?
My question is, we have removed a few trees years ago, and we filled the holes with dirt and then put sod or grass over them. But now, after a few years, the grass has kind of sunk because I guess the hole wasn't filled high enough. So my question is, can we just put more dirt over those holes and then grass, or do we have to actually take out the grass to put more dirt in?
I would take out the grass first. I mean, you would need a good 6 inches of soil so that the old, it doesn't interfere with root growth into that ground. And so, I mean, one thing you could do is just dig the grass out, leave it intact, put some more dirt in there, and just put the grass on top of it. But unless you have 6 inches, I would remove the old turf either way. And then just, but you can get a spade or a shovel and undercut it just like it's sawed. You know, if you're doing it personally, I wouldn't do it as thin as sod. I would leave another inch on there to leave some more roots because it will reestablish more quickly. But just dig those areas out and, you know, go in with a spade and undercut the sod, pull it back, put soil in to get it level. And don't mash it cement hard, but it's okay to just make sure that it's settled down and then just lay the sod back over the top. And because it's so cool, throughout the next 6 or 8 weeks, that sod will reestablish.
Oh, okay. All right. Good to know. Thank you.
All right, Debbie, thanks for your call this morning. Ton, next listener wants to know, is wood ash useful in the garden?
Not really, especially in Utah. Very small amounts don't hurt anything. Sometimes it's used to melt the snow off because of the dark color. Will absorb the sun's heat, but I wouldn't do more than about a 16th of an inch once a year over the entire garden. It does introduce potassium back into the soil, but it's also really salty. And so that's why I'm very cautious.
All right. Matt is on the line in Eagle Mountain. Good morning, Matt. What was your question?
Yes, I have a flowering pear tree that collapsed, starting to collapse. That I'm looking at transplanting honey locust that started from seed in my yard into that area. Is there going to be any issues with putting that honey locust where that flowering pear tree is?
Potentially, yes, because seed-grown honey locust oftentimes develop terrible thorns. The ones we grow have a recessive genetic trait of being thornless, but when they're pollinated, the characteristic of growing thorns comes back. And, excuse me, the new honey locust will, after 10 to 15 years, produce seeds every year in those big bean pods, and so it will develop into a very messy tree.
Not worth keeping honey locust around.
Well, if you wanted one, unfortunately, I know they're not cheap, but if you wanted a honey locust, I would hit a garden center and just get one that was thornless and seedless and plant it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Matt, thanks for your call this morning. We're going to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. And when we come back, Stephen, you'll be up next. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us, 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chalaos, Ton Bettis with you this morning. Taking your calls at 801-575-8255, where you can text your questions to 57500. Steve is on the line in Grantsville. And good morning, Steve. What was your question this morning?
Hey, good morning, guys. I was just calling. I put down some new sod the beginning of last October, and I'm just wondering what I can do to kind of get the best out of it. I was planning on putting down a first stage fertilizer, and I'm wondering if I should aerate or not.
No. You want to get that sod established for at least a year before you start aerating. So I think you'll damage it more with an aerator at this point. And so just the new fertilizer to do that, and then just mow it at 2.5 or 3 inches so that it has more grass blade there to form deeper roots.
Okay. Perfect. Sounds great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks so much for your call this morning. Next listener, Ton, says, is there anything that they need to do for the reddish needles on the top of their mugo pines?
They could be there for several reasons, and without more information, I can't really say. It could be salt damage, it could be drought damage, it could be spider mites, it could be scale.
So maybe they should be doing something.
They need to investigate. Maybe take some samples into their local extension office and have them checked out, or at least take pictures and email them to their local extension office.
Okay, next listener says, when should they remove the wrap from their saplings and fertilize them?
They can remove the wrap anytime. Add the fertilizer, they can get that down in the next couple of weeks.
Okay. Next listener wants to know when they should apply chelated iron around their peach trees.
I would do that in the next, it's probably fine now. So in the next 2 to 3 weeks, get it down.
Okay. So, next listener has been out of town for the last couple of months. They want to know what they've missed to do in the yard and garden. They want to know what needs to be done ASAP.
Clean up any leaves that are on the grass so they don't smother. Prune the fruit trees if they have fruit trees. Those are the main two things. Roses.
They need to be done right away.
Yes.
Okay. Next listener wants to know, how do you increase the pH level of the soil for raspberries?
You want to drop it.
Not increase
it. But you can't really do either in our soil very easily. And so the best thing to do is to incorporate lots of compost before they're planted, or top dress with an inch or so a couple times a year over around the crowns. And then I just would make sure if they've had problems with iron chlorosis that they put down the chelated iron that we've had several questions about, and soil drench with chelated iron so that the raspberries hopefully have enough in the soil that they have access to.
The next listener wants to know if you've tried the sweetie drop peppers. Have you ever tried those?
No.
Do you know what they are?
I looked them up during a break, and they look like they're one native to South America. But I'm liking more and more vegetables, so I don't want to be a downer here, but I'm just not a huge pepper fan. So I
come on, Tom. I love just, peppers.
I don't know why. I've started eating a lot more vegetables, and I joke about, you know, the Brussels sprouts sometimes and things, but peppers are just one that I just have never been able to get with. A few here and there are fine, but just to eat a pepper, or even in like Mexican cooking.
What about like chili and chili?
Well, it's a little different, but if you have stuffed peppers or what are they called? Not empanadas, where everything comes out sizzling and you put it in a tortilla and eat
fajitas.
Fajitas. The peppers, I just can't do it. I don't know.
With this diet I've been doing, like, peppers are one of my go-tos.
Yeah, and I would be in trouble. And I don't mean to disparage anybody that likes peppers. I can have, like, in salsa and a few things, or just a few, but when I get a lot of pepper, I don't know.
Okay, but would there be any special growing suggestions for those peppers?
If they could find seeds, I think that they would just be grown like any pepper.
Okay. Next listener would like to know, do Golden Delicious apples grow well here in Utah?
They are very well suited to the Wasatch Front. They've been declining in popularity for other apples because they don't store longer than 5 or 6 weeks. But they're my favorite apple, and they have been traditionally grown here for a long time, and they're actually one of the easier apples to take care of. They still need to be sprayed and managed for coddling moth, but they're a great apple for Utah.
You have a specific kind you would suggest?
Golden Delicious. There's a few different strains of Golden Delicious.
That's the
you
word
can
I was looking
find for. Like a spur type Golden Delicious that doesn't grow as aggressively. But it's more going to depend on how big of one they need. But the difficulty is even though there's different rootstocks that will control the size, it's really hard to find them and be able to purchase them unless you want to order like 100 of them.
Oh, no.
But, I mean, for me personally, just because of today's smaller yards, if you could find one that was on a dwarfing rootstock, I would just buy a $10 T-post, put it in next to the trunk, and just keep it supported with the T-post. But otherwise, a semi-dwarf Golden Delicious is fine.
Okay. Next listener lives in Roy. They have clay soil. The last 5 years, their autumn blaze maples have turned yellow early summer with an unhealthy look to the leaves. They want to know what they can do to maybe counter that.
The chelated iron we keep talking about, they would need to make an application within the next couple of weeks. The autumn blaze maple just isn't a great tree for Utah. And because they're turning yellow doesn't mean their soil is bad. It's just that we planted them here. And so they need to be deep watered, less often. So weekly during the summer, if they're established, maybe even every 10 days, but you would water to a depth of 18 inches and then don't water again, and you would water under the canopy. And so if they're in the lawn sprinklers, maybe deep watered every 2 or 3 weeks, but they're just sometimes a tough tree for Utah. And if you're looking for maple trees that have orange to red fall color, they're still not perfect, but the Pacific sunset or the Norwegian sunset maples are more adapted to our soils. They're susceptible to sun scald, so I would wrap them in the winter, but those would be what I would recommend.
Okay. Next listener wants to know if something's up. They've tried to buy fertilizer spurge killer at the big box stores, and they didn't have any in stock. You haven't heard about any shortages or anything. Maybe it's just a little early.
No, and if they're going after spurge, I think Isoxaben, which has been sold as Gallery or Galleria, there's several products, but if they were to hit up Steve Regan or IFA or Cal Ranch maybe, but local farm stores and garden centers will have a product with Isoxaben in it, and if they have spurge problems, that's actually going to be a better product.
I think that the biggest question today is going to be on aeration and dethatching. So I think for those listeners who are just tuning in, we probably need to rephrase what your thoughts are on both of those things and when they should do the aeration.
There's a Bible verse that's more referring to marriage that says, for those who cannot contain, it is better to marry than to burn.
What?
But in this situation, unless a lawn company that you've contracted with is doing the aeration, just take your aerator to your local religious leader and tell them that I can't control myself. Can I come get it in a month? That's what I'd recommend. And I think the scripture, it's not that you're going to burn for aerating early. It's fine. But if you can wait for 2 or 3 weeks, I really would.
Wait 2 or 3 weeks to aerate.
Yeah.
Do not dethatch.
And do not dethatch. And if you just can't control yourself, find a local religious leader and drop off your aerator until a later date.
I've been asked by some of our listeners not to try to stop you from making these crazy comments. So I'm going to just let you go.
During break, I'm going to get stood in the corner. I go sit on my chair and think about what I've done wrong.
Okay. We are going to take a break. Speaking of break, number to call with your questions. The phone lines are open at 801-575-8255. Text us 57500. Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls 801-575-8255. You can also text at 57500. Next listener wants to know, is it too late to prune roses in South Jordan?
No, it's actually a perfect time to do it.
I noticed I just have a couple of branches that need to be taken care of, but okay. Next person wants to know if you could tell them the best way and time to plant bare root strawberry plants. They have bought some online.
If they haven't arrived yet, that's a good thing. I would give it another couple of weeks at least.
Sounds like they have arrived, though.
So if they have arrived and they haven't started growing, I would just make sure that the roots do not dry out. And I actually would put them in my refrigerator for a couple of weeks before planting them. But when you're ready to plant, just follow the instructions. USU has some great raspberry fact sheets. But follow the instructions on them. And
these are strawberries, though.
Yeah, excuse me. Great strawberry fact sheets.
Thank you.
Misspoke there. And the roots are probably going to be 5 or 6 inches long. They can clip the bottom inch or two of the roots and then put them in the soil and plant them.
Okay. Sandy is on the line in Stansbury Park. Good morning, Sandy. What was your question?
Yes, I was wondering if it's too early to divide perennials.
No, do it. It's a great time.
Okay, good. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call this morning. Next person wants to know if they can cut back their ornamental grasses like the Carl Forrester and the maiden grass now.
Yeah, it's on. It's spring. It's time to do it. You can pull your pruners out. You can get your hedge trimmers out. You know, those grasses can be tough to cut back. And I've used a sharp machete, not just for the fact that it's a machete, but if you can gather the grass and just kind of, if you get it sharp enough, you can just cut and it'll cut right through the grass. Mm-hmm. A weed whacker, if it's not too thick, there's several things you can do, but those grasses can be quite difficult to cut back sometimes.
I know. I need to do mine. I wish I had done them in the fall, but since I didn't, I like to see them still there into the winter.
No, that's
but
great.
Then there's such a mess now.
One thing I used to do is just gather the top, and I might even tie it off and then use an electric hedge trimmer to just go in and cut it down that way.
I love that idea. Okay. Next person wants to know, what type of sealant should they put on a larger branch that they've cut off their peach tree that was damaged because of broken limbs?
None. Just let the tree do its thing. As long as
it will seal up by itself.
As long as it's pruned correctly, it will heal itself much better than we ever can.
This could be an autocorrect issue. This person wants to know, what are ramps? Can they grow in Utah gardens? Do you know?
I don't know.
I think that's an autocorrect issue. You might want to rephrase your question and ask us again. This person asks, is it too early to plant skip cherry laurel?
Oh, Skipka. It's another autocorrect. S-C-H-I-P-K-A. Skipka insis cherry laurel. If you can find them, you can probably plant them. But yeah, Skipka laurel. It's similar to...
Skip cherry sounds good.
Yeah, they're just called skips in the industry. And so someone is working for a garden center, or the garden center told them that's the name, but Skipka or Skipka insis. But they're just a tall English laurel.
Is it shade tolerant?
Yeah, that's where they need to be planted.
Okay. Next person would like to know if you could recommend any columnar apple or other fruit trees.
Well, there's not a lot of columnar fruit trees. Apples do. You can order them online. Sometimes Home Depot or Lowe's will have them, but they will get 2 or 3 feet wide and 10 to 12 feet tall. The apples are good. They're not going to be quite as good as a Fuji or a Gala or a Honeycrisp, but they're still good apples. And if you have limited space, they are a pretty good option. But otherwise, you can get dwarf peaches, but they're not columnar. And then you can get sometimes other dwarf apples that are on dwarfing rootstocks, but there are not a whole lot of options out there with columnar fruit trees besides the... They used to be sold as colonnade apples, but they're just sold as columnar apples.
Okay. Next person would like to know what kind of vitamins they should use for their red bud.
You know, it's actually an appropriate term, because when we put fertilizer on plants, it is not food. It's not plant food. It's nutrients. Mm-hmm. And so vitamins are nutrients. And so I think when people ask about that, that's actually a lot more appropriate than what plant food should I use, because food implies carbohydrates or protein. And it's
nutrients.
You didn't
like the fact that I giggled when I read that, did
well,
you?
And it's just not a really common term. But I think it is
appropriate,
but it's kind of cute too. So, but if your redbud is healthy, you don't need to do anything, you know. And if you did do anything, no more than just say, without knowing the size, it's hard, but no more than a half a cup of fertilizer, because redbuds have really brittle wood, and you don't want to cause a lot of uncontrolled growth, because it is going to be more likely to break.
All right. I'm going to try and squeeze James in here. He's from Lehigh. James, what was your question this morning?
Yeah, I'm looking at raised garden beds on the south side, you know, the sunny side of my house.
Uh-huh.
I noticed my daughter down in Vineyard built some out of bricks or something, and she had great tomatoes growing last year on her south side. There's galvanized, there's wooden. I've been looking. What would you recommend? And what's the height, say, for tomatoes? And you put underneath there, they're just open round circles, right?
Yeah, the tomatoes weren't excellent just because they were in raised beds. Your daughter was doing other things correctly to get them. Uh-huh. And so if you're going to build a raised bed, you want it at least 6 inches, but preferably a foot of growing space. And then the material is going to be what you can afford, because like the galvanized metal is expensive, but it will last forever. Where right. wood, let's say you use construction lumber, that's going to last you for 5 to 10 years before they need to be replaced. If you clean the soil out and on the inside, especially reapply linseed oil every year, put the soil back, that they'll last longer, but that's some work. And so it more boils down to what you can afford, how permanent they're going to be, and the look you want.
Yeah, I don't care for looks. It's all vinyl fenced and in and all. But I'm wondering, you set it on the regular turf, you know, I mean, ground that you have there. So do you dig that up and stir that up and mix it up and then put that thing over
it? You don't have to, but you don't want the grass eventually growing up through if they're not deep enough. And so I would recommend digging it out unless you have some sort of permanent barrier down there to prevent it from coming up.
All right, James, we're going to have to break. We need to take
a break
for the top of the hour news.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
I haven't seen the sky so blue. The birds are singing. I got nothing to do. Hey, hey,
hey, hey. It's a sunny day.
Sunny day now. My pocket's empty. My cupboard's bare. Call me illogical, I just don't care.
Hey, hey, hey,
hey, hey. It's just a sunny day.
Hey, 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 it's a sunny day.
It's just a sunny
It's the KSL Greenhouse. Expert tips for flowers, trees, gardens, and soil. Our hosts are Maria Chaleos and Ton Bettis on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you. We do have a special guest this morning as well, but I want you to know, Ton, our texters have let me know very clearly that they like your crazy comments and for me not to try to stop you.
Well, I do
so
need
I'm
to be...
I'm just going to give you free reign, and then if you are being bad, it's not up to me.
You keep me from getting in trouble, so...
That's what I thought
all
I was
good.
Doing, but
so
they,
please
they
keep
like
it up.
They like it.
Please
so
keep it up.
This morning, our top of the hour feature is maple syrup production, so tell our listeners why you want to talk about
this
morning.
Well, I was wandering around at Extension Annual Conference a week or two ago in a kind of a get-to-know-the-specialists and projects... what's going on at USU Extension. And I went past a booth where there were a set of grad students actually making maple syrup from local Big Tooth maple. Now, I know this isn't unheard of, but they've taken it to the point that you can actually buy local maple syrup from a few families down in southern Utah County in the Elk Ridge area. And there's potentially even a festival they do. And I was just so fascinated that someone was researching making this commercial that it was, I thought it'd be a good topic. But then they're also turning box elder trees, which are a species of maple, and Norway maple, and tapping them for syrup too. It's like, we've got to have them on. The nerd in me, the plant nerd, got the best of me.
Okay, so we are bringing on right now Jesse Matthews. He's a graduate researcher with Utah State University. Good morning, Jesse. Thanks for being with me. Us.
Awesome. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So how long have you been tapping maple trees?
So this is my third year of tapping maple trees here in Utah.
And what was this, just something the major professor says, I've got this project, or were you already interested in it?
Yeah, so I actually was just kind of at the right place at the right time. I worked as an undergrad research assistant, and this project kind of started as I was an undergrad assistant, and then I graduated and became a graduate research assistant. And he got a grant to study this here in Utah. And so I was just kind of in the right lab and got involved in it that way.
No, that's excellent. So as you are researching these maples, can you briefly walk us through the process of actually tapping a native Big Tooth maple?
Yeah, it's pretty easy. You just got to have a spile, which is your little part that you put into the tree, and a bucket, and a lid, preferably something to cover it so nothing falls into it. And really, once you have that, you just get a drill bit, anything from Home Depot works, and you drill a hole about 1.5 inches deep, then you use a hammer to pound your spile in, and then hang your bucket, and you're off to the races. It's pretty simple.
So how much syrup do you get out of the tree, and then can you just eat it like that, or what do you have to do to it?
Yeah, so the sap, when it comes out of the tree, is about 2% sugar, and it's got lots of nutrients and minerals in it. So a lot of people will just drink the sap as you get it straight out of the tree. And you get about, from box elder, on average, you get about 7 gallons of sap from a tree, and that can vary a lot. You can get a lot more or a lot less depending on your tree. For big tooth maple, it's a little less. It's closer to like 5 gallons of sap. But then if you want to make maple syrup, you need to boil that down. And so it goes from 2% sugar in the sap, and maple syrup is 67% sugar. And so the general quoted ratio is about 40 gallons of sap make a gallon of syrup.
So that's a lot of boiling to get it concentrated.
Yeah. So it's really easy to do it. You just keep it on the stove for a long time.
Doesn't this hurt the poor tree? Like, that's a lot of sap to come out of a tree, isn't it?
Not really. We're taking such a small portion that they don't even really notice it. And the hole that you drill is so small, it's a lot less damage than you see with other wounding scars that happen naturally in nature. So it really, the tree hardly even notices this tiny little hole that you put into it or what you take out of it. We're accessing such a small part of what's going on in the tree that the tree doesn't even really notice.
So I noticed that you had the finished retail bottles at the conference. So how has the public received the local maple syrup as far as taste, and what kind of comments are you getting?
Yeah, everyone absolutely loves it. If you're familiar with maple syrup from back east, we get those come from sugar maples, red maples, silver maples. It's often has kind of a strong flavor that a lot of people don't like if you're not used to it. But this maple syrup that we've produced here has a lot lighter flavor. People have said it has caramel notes to it or buttery notes to it. Everyone kind of has their own take on it, but everyone absolutely loves it. It's a little bit easier of a flavor. It's not as strong.
So I guess you'd have to become a maple syrup sommelier to really start figuring a lot of this stuff out. And so on the box elder syrup and the Norway maple syrup, what have the comments been on them?
So box elder and Norway maple haven't been produced and sold to anyone. So
okay.
I only have my personal notes on that because I've made them individually. Just me. And they both have their own little different flavors. It all tastes like maple syrup. It's all really sweet. Box elder syrup definitely has a unique flavor, just because they're just a unique tree in general in the maple species world. And Norway maple is actually really sweet as well. But you get a lot less Norway maple syrup or sap from the tree, so it's a lot harder to produce.
I had heard that of all the maple species, that Norway was the hardest to tap because of that. And so it's just interesting to me. Where do people find out more information about local maple syrup?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we've got lots of resources. We hold workshops starting in probably about October, November, and going through February. We have workshops that are held all over the place. I've also produced and written fact sheets to help guide people through the whole process, everything from identifying which trees I can tap all the way through creating your own maple syrup. And so those fact sheets are available on the Utah State University website. And I think the one that you want to start with is titled Producing Maple Syrup from Box Elder and Norway Maple Trees.
Okay, Jesse, before we let you go, I have to ask, though, this isn't something somebody can go out, do today, buy a tree and then start. How mature does the tree have to be before you can tap it?
Yes, that's a great question. Very important. The general rule of thumb is you want to tap at about 10 inches in diameter. So you can tap smaller, but 10 inches is the safe tapping size, and anything bigger, you can definitely tap.
So if you're tapping wild trees, those trees could easily be 50 to 100 years old before they are suitable for tapping.
Yeah, in general, they're going to be, well, depending on the species, box elder trees, probably within 20 years.
So I'm referring to the big tooth.
Probably takes a lot longer.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're more of a scrubby multi-trunk. And so it's hard to find large big tooth maples. So for my research, we've been tapping clear down to 7 inches for big tooth maple just because it's so hard to find those bigger ones.
All right, Jesse, thank you so much for sharing your information with us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to. I love this.
Before you go, quick question. Are there any local retailers of especially the big tooth maple syrup?
There's only one, and it's in Woodland Hills, Utah. And we're getting to the end of the season. They've got tons of bottles this year. And it's right now, this is their second year, it's only sold at one place, and that is they hold a maple syrup festival. This year, it's on April 20th at 10 o'clock, starting at 10 o'clock in Woodland Hills in a park called Lartson Field. That's the only place where you can buy locally produced maple syrup in Utah.
Very good. So maybe we'll have you hold on the line off the air, and I'll have Michelle get that information from you, and we might be able to put it on our social media. But we greatly appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, that sounds great. Thank you for having me.
All right, Jesse, thank you. That is Jesse Matthews. He's a graduate researcher with Utah State University talking about the Maple Syrup Project. Take a break. Coming back with your questions and your calls, you can call us now, 801-575-8255. Karen, you'll be up next. And you can text us at 57500. Good morning. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls and questions. Ton, we needed to correct something that we talked about earlier. I asked you about ramps.
Yes.
And you had never heard of ramps.
No.
And then you got texts, and then you got email. Yeah.
Liz Binks, who is one of our USU Extension insect diagnosticians and overall good gardener and just a good person, texted me and saying that wasn't
autocorrect. Ramps are a thing. So what are they?
They are an onion species, an allium species that are native to Europe and Eastern North America, that you only have a window of about 2 weeks to harvest, and they're perennial, and you can get a patch started where it looked like they grow is kind of in woodsy, dappled shade areas, but they're very slow to establish.
Okay, and so can be grown here.
I suspect they can. Nobody I know of is growing them. Liz wasn't, but she was more up to speed on them than me. But I suspect they would grow here, because if they're growing in New Hampshire and Massachusetts, if you had an area here with organic matter and things, I think they would be fine.
All right, Liz, thanks for listening and clarifying for us. Karen is on the line in Riverton. Good morning, Karen. What was your question this morning?
Good morning. My question pertains to adding nitrogen to grow boxes. We've had grow boxes for about 15 years, and self-made soil with a compost, the peat, and the vermiculite, done wonderful. Finally had it tested. I was just curious. And my test from USU came back with very high phosphorus and potassium, and only recommended to add nitrogen. So my question is, when is the best time to put it in the soil? Do I put it now?
No, when you plant. Nitrogen is so mobile that I would download the fact sheets for whatever crops you're growing from USU's website, and it will give you instructions on when to apply nitrogen. It's just assumed that the soil is low in nitrogen because it just is so water soluble, it doesn't stay in the soil long. So on your raised beds, have you been adding compost back in every fall or periodically?
Yes, we do.
Okay, good.
We do add it.
Good. So yeah, just straight nitrogen fertilizer. And so when you read USU fact sheets, they may say 16-16-16 or 10-10-10 or 20-0-0. Just assume that you're using 20-0-0 or 21-0-0 and use that for your nitrogen source, so you're not putting the other two nutrients in.
Okay. And I look, there's the ammonium sulfate, and there's also blood meal. Is there one that's better than the other?
No, not necessarily. Ammonium sulfate is the 20-0-0. That's just the analysis of it. And blood meal, I believe, is a 12%. And so you would need to do the math on because the first number in the analysis is nitrogen. And if it's saying use 2 tablespoons of 20-0-0, which is the phosphate, then blood meal, you would double that to get the same amount of nitrogen.
Okay. Great.
All right.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call this morning.
Mm-hmm.
Next listener wants to know, should they top dress their lawn? How would they decide if it was time to do a little bit of overseeding?
If they need to top dress the lawn because the grass is thin or they have a lot of weeds, they need to figure out why it's thin or why the weeds are there, because top dressing at best will be a temporary solution.
Can they do that now if they need to?
They can, yes.
Okay. This next listener says, they had bazillions of grasshoppers last couple of years. Is there something that they can do now to prepare in defense?
You know, USU has some really good grasshopper fact sheets out there. And to truly control them, it's a neighborhood-wide effort. Mm-hmm. And during COVID, one of our main defenses, which was called NoloBait, the company that manufactures it either went bankrupt or they've had failures. I don't know. But NoloBait has not been available. And that was a bait you would put out in the spring. As soon as you started seeing the little baby grasshoppers, they would eat it. And then they would either die or not feed anymore and die. But since that tool is gone, then that leaves us with other strategies. And in your yard, if it's just you, you can observe the plants they like the best and spray them with an insecticide and use those as a trap crop to keep them out of your other garden areas. And so if they're coming from a certain direction and you know that they like, say, marigolds, you might plant two or three rows of marigolds on the edge of the garden because they're going to prefer those, and you might be able to spray the marigolds and not have to spray in your garden.
Ah.
And so there's some things like that you can do, but download USU's fact sheets on grasshoppers. And if you have some neighbors that are cooperative, you might be able to work with them, because the more neighbors that participate, the better the control is going to be, because the grasshoppers are so mobile. Even if you eliminate them from your yard, it's just a few hours before they start hopping back in.
All right. Next listener wants to know, is it okay to use water from a rain barrel to water your vegetables? They're wondering if the chemicals from the shingles would harm the vegetables.
I think you're fine.
Okay.
That falls all over your lawn, and the lawn usually survives okay. And so it's just one of those things that the rainwater is in contact with those shingles for such a short period of time. And there's generally on those shingles, there might even be a light coating of lime or calcium carbonate just from rain and things. Mm-hmm. And so as far as watering your plants with it, you're perfectly fine.
Okay. And the next listener wants to know, what is the optimum exposure for a mock orange, and how much dead stock can they cut off from them without killing them?
If it's dead, just cut it out. You're not going to kill anything.
Yeah, cut the dead off. They may not know if it's living right now.
Yeah, and so mock orange, when you prune them after they're done blooming, and you go in and take 25 to 30% of the branches out toward the middle of the bush, starting with the oldest, longest branches, and then you can give it a light haircut. But you do it within just a few days after it's done blooming, because it's forming flower buds for the next year very soon. And so if you do that, the mock orange are beautiful, but they have a tendency to get leggy and just kind of not great looking if you don't prune them. But renewal pruning keeps their shape. They want at least 6 hours of sunlight a day. 8 is better.
So. All right. We need to take a break for the bottom of the hour news. When we come back, Reed, your call will be up next. Then Wendy. Number to call with your questions, 801-575-8255. You can text us, 57500.
The Greenhouse Show on KSL News Radio.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us for the KSL Greenhouse. Maria Chalais, Ton Bettis with you, taking your calls at 801-575-8255. You can also text us at 57500. Reed has been waiting very patiently in Orem. And good morning, Reed. What was your question this morning?
Hi, Maria and Tom. I appreciate you taking my call. We installed our sprinkler system about 20 years ago, and at that time decided to broadcast spray our shrubs, our bushes, and our trees. But I'd like to convert that to drip irrigation, and I have what I think is a good design. The trees we have now are a 3-inch caliper peach tree, 3-inch caliper swamp tree, and an older 3-inch crab apple. I'm just wondering at what rate I should be watering these and where to place the emitters and any advice you have as I do this.
Well, the trees, that once you install a drip, it's not going to be a static system like a traditional sprinkling system would. As the tree canopies grow, every 3 or 4 years, you're going to have to put in another circle of drip around the trees. And so you keep that in mind and have the capacity to increase the number of either drip emitters or inline. And I would actually recommend inline the hose, or the where you have evenly spaced emitters on the tubing instead of just the individual emitters, just so that you can cover better. And you'd put those every couple of feet circling almost like a bullseye target under the canopy of the tree. And so generally, and you need to know your soil type, because it can be difficult to know how the spacing and how long to run, because in a sandy soil for those trees, you would probably want inline drip with emitters every foot, and you'd space those every couple of feet because water just flows right through sand, but you wouldn't run it as long and you would run it more often because the sand dries out more quickly. If you have a loamy soil, which is great, then, you know, you might be able to space those a little bit farther apart, and 1 inch of water. So I don't know, do your emitters tell you gallons per hour or do they say inches per hour of water?
Gallons per hour.
So if you had a square foot and you applied 1 inch of water to that square foot, what would happen is that in a loam soil, that would penetrate 6 inches to a foot deep. In a sandy soil, it would go a foot to 2 feet, and in a clay, it would go 3 or 4 inches at the most and then go sideways. And as this water flows through the soil, in sand, it almost goes straight down. In the loam, it kind of forms a pyramid shape as it spreads out as it goes down, and then in clay, it almost goes sideways. And so you need to be aware of how water flows in your soil to know the spacing. And so what I'd recommend doing is having BYU or USU do a soil test to figure out if you've got loam, sand, or clay soil. And you can adjust your emitters according to how the water flows in the soil. But your goal is to drive water, if you have a loam or a sandy soil, especially 18 inches to 2 feet on your trees, to the, you know, toward the bottom of most of your feeder roots are going, and then you want those emitters spaced under the canopy.
And how long do you typically is this a deep watering, once a week?
Hopefully, it is. If those trees are established once a week, maybe even every 10 days is great. But if they're brand new trees, then you may need to water a couple of times a week. And it's just really difficult for me to say, you know, run that irrigation for 45 minutes, because all soils are different and the emitter spacing is different. And so what I would recommend doing is getting your soil type so that you can figure out if it's sand, silt, or clay, because that's going to have everything to do with your emitter spacing and your run time.
Okay. All right. I think that confirms some stuff that I've read online, and I'll get my soil tested.
Yeah. And if you're not in a super windy area and you haven't gone to this extent yet for your fruit trees and things, especially if they're not in your lawn, I might consider micro sprays that spray a foot or 18 inches off the ground, but go 5 or 6 feet wide, and using 2 or 3 of those per tree and letting them run for several hours so that you get a more even distribution of water under the canopy.
Okay, and if I have shrubs around those trees, it's just a matter of...
Then you have to use drip, because the micro sprays will run into the shrubs and they won't water like they're supposed to.
Okay.
But there are some other options. I would hit a professional sprinkler store like Sprinkler Supply, The Sprinkler Store, Standard Plumbing. There's several of them out there. But I would talk to them on your situation, maybe bring in your plans, and they'll have somebody that can help you with spacing and pressure and things like that. But you do need to know your soil type.
Okay. Great. I appreciate your time and all the advice you continue to give to our community.
Thank you.
Thanks, Reed, for your call this morning. Next listener wanted to know, Ton, when and how to treat scale on a sycamore.
There's a few options. One of the easiest, but it might be a little more expensive, is to use something like Safari or Xylem and do a soil drench around the trunk of the tree this spring and just let that absorb in. It can take a few months to get through the system, but either Safari or Xylem will knock those out. Otherwise, they can use dormant oils, but they need to be able to cover the canopy of the tree. If they can't, they're going to need to use a systemic.
All right. Next person says they have a dwarf apple tree, but every year the apples are wormy. What can they do to fix the problem?
Look up USU's fact sheet on codling moth. They are going to be wormy because you need to spray at multiple occasions through the season. And so USU's Pest Lab Updates, there's a fruit update that you can subscribe to for free. Google USU Pest Lab Updates. And what I would recommend doing is just subscribing, and they will tell you down to the day when you need to spray. They'll give you, when available, non-pesticide options, organic options, and standard options. So that's what I would do.
All right. Next listener is Wendy in Brigham City. Good morning, Wendy. What was your question this morning?
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. We have a dwarf pear tree. We've had probably 15 to 20 years, and the fruit has always been real good. And this past fall, when we got the fruit ready to can, I tasted it, and it tasted like turpentine. I sampled quite a few of the pears. They all tasted the same, so we had to throw away all the pears. We're wondering if we need to take the tree out. We kind of want to give it one more year to see if it'll rally and do better, but why
what
would it
if
like
it was
that?
Your fault that the fruit was like that and not the trees?
What?
And not intentionally. And the tree didn't all of a sudden become demon possessed or anything. But a lot of times when the entire tree, all the pears taste like that, it's because of weather conditions or management practices. If it was a fruit here and there, you could blame it on a disease. But if it's the entire tree, something's gone wrong in the environment, usually to cause that to happen. And so how was the tree irrigated last year?
We have it in a corner of the yard that the sprinkler system hits. And then if it doesn't seem to be wet enough, I water it. I just drag the hose over and turn it on for a couple hours on real low water.
And how long are your sprinklers hitting it?
15 minutes tops.
15 minutes. So it may not be enough. What I would do is get a hose and sprinkler that will water under the canopy of the tree and run it every 2 to 3 weeks for an extra half hour to 45 minutes, besides what your lawn sprinklers are doing to drive the water deeper. Okay. Last summer, we were so hot through July that where maybe if we stayed in the 90s, the water the tree was getting may have been sufficient. But I think that during a critical period of the season, the tree unintentionally didn't get enough water, and it caused the fruit to taste like that. And so the reason I suspect this is because commercial growers didn't have any problems with fruit as far as flavor and yields and things like that. And that usually, if homeowners are having problems, then it usually goes back to management practices. So I don't mean to accuse you of anything, and I didn't mean to, if it sounded like that, I apologize.
No,
but a lot of times, if the entire tree has fruit that doesn't taste good, then it's something that we didn't realize we needed to do that maybe caused that fruit to taste like that. So I would at least give it another year to see, with just increasing irrigation slightly to where you drive water down, you know, a good. So when you're going to water this is when your sprinklers run the next morning, I would go out there and just run a hose and sprinkler for an extra half hour to 45 minutes to get the water deeper, and do that twice a month and see if that helps.
Okay, great. Thank you.
If it doesn't and the pears taste bad again, there could be a disease in there, and then you could cut it down. But I would definitely give it another year.
That's kind of what we thought too.
All right, Wendy. Thank you so much for your call this morning.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Our next listener, Ton, wants to know, they've had some tulips in a bag. They want to know what happens if they plant them now. They probably won't come up this year, but will they come up next year?
Probably not. They may leaf out, but not form flowers. I would definitely plant them, but so they don't get their hopes up, I might just dig an area or designate an area of my yard and see if they leaf out and let them do their thing. And then the next fall, they could move them where they want them if they do.
All right. We're going to take a break. Come back with your calls and questions. Number to call 801-575-8255. Text us 57500. Thank you for spending your Saturday morning with the KSL Greenhouse. Maria and Ton with you, taking your calls and questions. We only have a few minutes left in the program. And Ton, the next listener wants to know, they need to move a wisteria that's been growing in a pot. It's been in there about for 4 years now. They started it from seeds, but they're wondering if it's going to be tolerant to moving it at this point.
Yeah, it'd be a great time to move it before it breaks dormancy. If they can't pull it out of the pot, if it's a cement pot or a clay pot, they may need to shatter the pot carefully to get it out.
Mm-hmm.
If it's plastic, cut it. And if I wouldn't recommend using a Sawzall, but a strong blade, something or another to cut it. If it is a resin pot, then they may need to cut that also. If it is a brittle or harder pot, they might be able to shatter it, but it will need to come out. If it's too big, they may need to break the pot off, but it's a great time to transplant it.
Our next listener has 12 apple trees in their backyard. They want to plant a hedge of elderberries, but they're wondering if the elderberries will bring in birds and that might potentially harm their apple trees.
Not necessarily. Those elderberries ripen through late September into October. And the only danger would be if they have apples like Golden Delicious or a Fuji, that Granny Smith is another one that would ripen later in the season. When the elderberries are, it could bring birds in, but I think the birds, I can't be sure, but I think they had preferentially take the elderberries over the apples.
All right. Blake is on the line in Pleasant View. Good morning, Blake. What was your question this morning?
Hey, big old question. I've got a tree, 8 years old, maple tree, Pleasant View. It needs iron. I had a guy put in some iron, but he's not around. What's the best way to put in iron? Because it's just not doing very well.
How big is the tree?
It's about 25 feet tall now.
Okay, so I would hit IFA, Cal Ranch, Steve Regan, a local garden center. I think you've got Jerry's up your way, J&J,
yeah,
Valley Nursery.
Yeah.
So I'd hit one of them and buy some. Just tell them you need EDDHA iron. It's Miller Ferroplus, EDDHA. So it's Miller Ferroplus or Grow More Chelated Iron.
Okay.
And read the instructions because you may need more than one container. I don't think so, but what you're going to do is look at the instructions and it'll tell you how much to apply per inch of trunk width. And you'll mix that up in 5 gallon buckets and just drench it under the canopy of the tree, not just by the trunk, but you're going back and forth to the edge of the tree and then get your hose out and water that in for 15 or 20 minutes to drive the iron down into the soil.
Okay. Hey, some guy said I should drill in the trunk.
No,
like 12
that's
holes
last ditch. The tree's going to die before you do that, because every hole you drill and inject iron into, you get a 2-inch ring that rots. And so
and
so if you do that too often, you can actually girdle the tree, and it is not good for it. That's only if the tree is going to die. And so you want to do this chelated iron treatment. But what I would do in addition to that is maybe get some liquid micronutrients and mix in with it. And also, and you're going to kind of make a witch's brew, I would get some liquid chelate. Liquid humates or some granular humates and put those down at the same time. And I would also get some liquid nitrogen and put it down all at once. And you might need to apply separately, but within the same hour, because what you're trying to do is maximize uptake of the micronutrients and the iron, and the nitrogen may help a little bit. The chelate or the humates may help a little bit, and just you're doing everything you can do to pull this tree out of being unhealthy.
All right, Blake, thank you so much for your call this morning.
Yeah.
That's it for the KSL Greenhouse. Show goes by just so quickly. We appreciate you joining us this morning. If you've missed a portion of the show, you can find it in podcast form at kslpodcast.com. 8 o'clock hour, we talked about summer bulbs. You can find out more information about the summer blooming bulbs on the KSL Greenhouse Facebook page. Then we talked to the Utah Rose Society at 9 and then learned about maple syrup production in the state at 10. So, Ton, have a great weekend.
You have a great weekend also.
All right. And thank you again for listening to the KSL Greenhouse. We appreciate your calls and texts.